Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Sheckman.
There are billions of dollars of contracts being let on all occasions, but there are very few of them being sent to those areas where the 8, 9, 10, 11, or 12% of the population is unemployed. I think federal aid to education, I think the passage of the Paran bill, which provides medical assistance for those over 65, an effective minimum wage bill, which I'm now sponsoring in the Senate, federal minimum standards for the payment of unemployment compensation. I think vigorous action by the federal government can make a great difference to West Virginia. In the final analysis, what happens in this state depends in part on the vigor of the citizens. But I must say we can do far better than we have done in last years by this administration, which has vetoed and held back all the action which is needed if West Virginia is going to move ahead.
That was John F. Kennedy campaigning in the West Virginia primary in 1960. It's amazing how many of those same ideas and issues are still haunting us today. Then it was the Republicans who didn't seem to understand the plight of Appalachia and of working America. Democrats in the person of JFK and later Johnson and Bobby Kennedy made the personal and policy connection. So what happened? How did their party lose touch with that part of America? The answers are complicated and probably best left to historians. However, how the party reconnects is a very contemporary political issue. Books are flying off the shelf trying to explain flyover country to Democrats. Books like Arlie Hochschild's Strangers in Their Own Land, Tyler Cowen's The Complacent Class, and most notably, J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. But is it possible that some of these books, particularly Vance's, teach the wrong lesson? That just like 1960, the lesson is not one of promulgating conservative culture and Horatio Alger attitudes, but of the failure of government to do the right thing. Take a listen to Bobby Kennedy campaigning in Kentucky in 1968.
Well, people are still having a very, very difficult time. There is a hunger, considerable hunger in this part of the country. There's no real hope for the future amongst many of these people who worked hard in the coal mines, and now that the coal mines shut down, they have no place to go. There's no hope for the future. There's no industry moving in. The men are trained in government programs, and there's no jobs at the end of the training program because of the cutback, because of the demands on our federal budget in Washington, and so people are being cut off, and they have no place to turn, and so they're desperate and filled with despair. It seems to me that this country is wealthy as we are, that this is an intolerable condition. It reflects on all of us. We can do things all over the rest of the world, but I think we should do something for our people here in this, in our own country.
To talk about and examine all of this, I am joined by Sarah Jones, who's the social media editor at The New Republic, and whose article, J.D. Vance, The False Prophet of Blue America, appears in The New Republic. It is my pleasure to welcome Sarah Jones. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It is remarkable that given the history of the Democratic Party in understanding these issues of working class America and Appalachia and listening to those clips from Bobby Kennedy and JFK, that the party at the moment seems so desperate to try and understand that part of the country.
I agree. And I think it's the result of just kind of years of neglect, moving away from progressive populism and neglecting politics at the state level, which is really a good way to reach out to these people.
And talk a little bit about, as you look at it, what you were beginning to see, as you said about writing this article and looking at Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, the way in which that desperation is really creating the wrong message, the wrong ideas that seem to be filtering into the party.
From my perspective, you know, just as someone who grew up in this area and has kind of moved away from it and is now looking kind of from the outside, it just seems to me that the Democratic Party kind of just wrote this voter base off. Well, okay, like we're not going to win them. We can still win national elections without them. And now we can see that that was kind of an egregious miscalculation this time around. And I think books like Hillbilly Elegy, they kind of confirm stereotypes that people already have about white working class voters, especially white working class people in Appalachia. So I wasn't particularly surprised to see, you know, that his book had been so popular even among some liberals, but it was very concerning and indicative to me of broader problems within the Democratic establishment.
Talk about the conservative message, the kind of bring yourself up by the bootstraps message that's so much a part of what Vance writes about, and really disconnect from public policy.
Right. So Vance, to his credit, I mean, he had a very chaotic, dysfunctional childhood, and he's managed to achieve a lot. And that took, you know, hard work, a lot of effort. He deserves credit for that because I, you know, having grown up in a similar region and trying to make it on my own, like, it is difficult. But he seems to have looked at his individual experience and projected it on the region at large, and I think that's a very dangerous thing to do. The ways that he was able to make it out, join the Marine Corps, for example, are avenues that are not necessarily going to be open to everyone. Furthermore, do we really want a country where you have to join the Marine Corps and get deployed to Iraq in order to you know, get into Ohio State and then Yale Law? You know, it should be easier than that. So when I, like, as a memoir, the book is interesting, and it would have been fine if he just left it as a memoir. Instead, it's kind of presented as like an explainer on hillbilly culture, and here's what needs to happen. And as a result, it's very limited and very flawed. You know, if you just work a little bit harder, pray a little bit harder, you know, fix this crisis of masculinity, which he never really quite explained, then things will be at least better, if not fine. And that's just very unusual to me. There's a lot of public policy that you're leaving out of that analysis.
And talk a little bit about the fact that he looks at it and presents it as a cultural problem more than an economic problem in many respects.
Right, which is also a bit strange to me. I don't know a great deal about Vance's religious views, so I don't want to rush any assumptions here. But I do know that he identifies as a religious conservative, and I do see that as being indicative of kind of religious conservatism based on my experience with it. You know, it's a problem of the heart. Some Christians would call it the sin nature. And if you get right with God, if you live a godly life, then things will be better. And I see it, you know, he doesn't quite say that explicitly, but I see it as being related, this idea of if you fix cultural problems, if you fix these problems of the heart, then things will get better. But of course, nothing is ever that simplistic.
And with respect to the public policy aspect, in many ways, the book is a kind of screed against welfare, against public policy and government really having an important role to play.
Yeah, it was very odd to me and just very surreal, actually, to read someone write that, you know, there were sufficient services available for people when it's very clear that there are not sufficient services available for people. You know, in my part of Southwest Virginia, people will start lining up at 4 a.m. to start accessing remote access medical, which is a rural clinic that offers free medical services. And that didn't change after Obamacare. Like, people still need these services, and these are people who aren't able to access basic health care. Now, that's clearly a failing of the welfare state. You know, you look at our public schools, and I don't know what his public school was like, but mine certainly didn't have enough equipment or textbooks or advanced classes for kids who wanted to go to college. Again, that's an issue of government funding not being distributed properly. So there are very clearly policy problems. And when you look at the problem of Appalachia now, and you look at the problem of declining coal jobs and manufacturing jobs, the solutions to these, you know, include the policy aspect. Do we talk about raising the minimum wage for service jobs? Do we talk about universal basic income? What's the solution? You know, instead, he kind of just focuses on this cultural issue, and it's very reminiscent, and several people, not just myself, have made this point, of the old welfare queen myth and culture of poverty myth. And it was simplistic the first time it was proposed, and it's simplistic now applied to white working class people in Appalachia.
It's also interesting to look at this in this broader historical context that many of these issues and many of these problems have been festering for 60, 70 plus years.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, when you're looking at economic decline specifically, mining and manufacturing jobs have been declining for decades. You know, this conservatives often pin this to the Obama administration and the EPA and environmentalism, but the truth is, you know, this is almost more a story about automation, just natural changes to the industry. So we've been kind of getting to this point of economic crisis in Appalachia for a long time now. And the area has, like, even when these industries were stronger, obviously, the area was never wealthy. So this isn't new. This has been around a long, long time. And I see it as just the result of kind of decades of government inability to address it the way that it needs to be addressed, and this general reluctance, this tendency to connect, you know, do you deserve welfare, instead of viewing things like healthcare and education and having enough food and a roof over your head as just basic human rights.
Certainly what it goes to, and what's been a big discussion in coming out of this recent election and where so much of this goes, is whether or not voters in these places are really clearly voting against their own economic self-interest.
It's a really interesting question, because in a sense, that is a true thing to say. Like, I don't think anyone reasonable anyway can look at Donald Trump and say that his administration is going to be better for these people. You know, I don't buy for a single second that Donald Trump really actually cares about the plight of the white working class, or that, you know, as president, his priority is going to be fixing Appalachia. That's simply not true. But they don't see it this way, so they don't see it as voting against their interests. They really do believe that he's going to bring the jobs back, and they're not wrong to be suspicious of promises from the Democratic Party necessarily, because, you know, Appalachia, people made a lot of promises to Appalachia, and the poverty is still what it is.
One of the points that you make in your piece in the New Republic is that while Democrats may not understand what's really going on there, there are a lot of other groups, even beyond Donald Trump, a lot of other groups that really do seem to understand and are trying to exploit and take advantage.
Right. The Democratic Party, in my opinion, has failed to connect with people on a local level. My colleagues, Alex Shepard and Nicole Nerea, just had a piece up in the New Republic about the Democratic Party's failures at the state level and how they currently don't control a single state legislature in the South, which is unprecedented. That's a massive failure of leadership at the Democratic Party. So they've created a void, and the Tea Party wing of the GOP especially has been very good at filling it. So now we see the results of that. You have these extremist groups, you have these white supremacist groups, like the Workers' Traditionalist Party, who are at least saying, you know, who knows if they'll actually do it, but they're saying, you know, we're gonna do a voter outreach push in Appalachia. Well, they're doing that because they see correctly that there's a political void that exists.
Talk a little bit about the idea of looking at all of this without the possibility, which is essentially what Vance does, without the possibility of government solutions, and where he thinks the answer will come from, other than just pulling oneself up by one's bootstraps.
You know, that's one of my major criticisms of the book, is that it's never very clear where he thinks these solutions are going to come from, except, you know, he rules out the possibility of them coming from the government. So what does that leave us with? It leaves us with private entities. I don't think that's the answer, because private entities are not answerable to the people the way the government is ostensibly supposed to be. It just doesn't leave you much room to actually think of solutions or the government's role in any of this.
Part of the other issue with these places, and you can speak about it from your own experience, is the way in which they have been hollowed out in so many respects, not only in terms of jobs, not only in terms of the economy, but even in terms of media, even in terms of local newspapers or the local opportunities for people to communicate in these places.
Yeah, I mean, one of my very first jobs in journalism was working, you know, writing little freelance stories for the Bristol Herald Courier down in Bristol, Virginia. And these little local papers, I shouldn't call them little, because they do play such an important role in bringing communities together and educating communities. I mean, the Bristol Herald even won a Pulitzer a few years ago for its work. They're doing really important work, and they have a really important role to play. But, you know, journalism as an industry is suffering some difficulties, and I think that affects these little papers a lot, and that's unfortunate, especially as we're considering the rise of issues like fake news trending on Facebook. Again, you know, you see people exploiting a void.
What do you see, both from the things that Vance writes about and from your own experience, in terms of the generational change in these places? Because certainly some of these issues seem to pass from generation to generation, really without any change.
Right. That's a really interesting question. Mining jobs specifically were kind of viewed as generational jobs. So same thing with unionized factory jobs, where they could be passed down from generation to generation. And it was a way for a person to have a fairly comfortable living without a college education, and now that's not happening. So I, you know, that's an interesting thing to consider. You do have generational cycles of poverty as well. And Appalachia itself, you know, culturally, it's a very, you know, your family is very important, and it's very difficult if your family's been living in the same place, doing the same work for generations upon generations, you know, to just up and leave. It's very difficult.
How hard is it for young people to get out?
It's very difficult overall, I would say. I mean, again, you have certain family pressures where, again, like your whole family, your extended family have lived in this place for centuries in some cases. And so, you know, being maybe the first person to break out of that is very difficult. But also because the region is so impoverished overall, that makes it much more difficult for people to say be the first one in their families to go to college. And then, you know, maybe you go to college, maybe you do make it that far. And then you might not be able to find work in your area. So where does that leave you?
Talk about the state of education in this part of the country.
You know, it's difficult. I mean, I graduated from a public high school. You know, for the most part, I had teachers who tried very hard, but they just didn't have a lot of resources. And that, you know, that means kids are at kind of a disadvantage from the very beginning. And makes them less likely to be able to go to college and maybe like go on to careers later on. I think education is very important. I think investing in education properly in the colleges and universities that exist in the area, community colleges that specialize in vocational training, you know, that is one way to help revitalize the area and maybe bring some economic growth. But unfortunately, given the way the state legislatures are stacked right now, it just seems unlikely that this is going to happen the way that it needs to.
Of course, the elephant in the room of all of this is the degree to which, as you write about, racism and misogyny are really so caught up in, so interwoven with so many of these other issues.
Right. I mean, we're talking about the South, so like you can't really have a conversation without factoring racism into it. And it is a very racist place, and it is a very sexist place. Of course, a lot of the places in America that are not in the South are also racist and sexist. But I think that absolutely plays a part in this, and it can't be overstated too much, I think. You know, this is also very, it's less racially homogenous than it used to be. That's beginning to change, but it has historically been at least somewhat racially homogenous. And I think that's also a factor to be that isolated from the rest of the world. There's less excuse for that than there used to be, mainly thanks to the internet, to be exposed to different cultures and ways of looking at the world. But, you know, the older generations especially, I feel like they've been a bit less tolerant.
The other point of this, as you point out, is that so much of this plays into liberal stereotypes of this part of the country.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know what people think about white trash. I've encountered it before, and that, you know, stereotypes about white trash, liberals have plenty of them themselves. You know, I can't even count the times I've heard liberal people joke about flyover country or, you know, people kind of getting what they deserve because they vote the way that they do. All the redneck jokes, the hillbilly jokes, and just people make these observations and jokes really unthinkingly. But they don't pass without notice in my part of the world, and it does build resentment.
And is that resentment pretty much the expression of what we have seen take place in this election?
I think that is part of it. I don't want to discount how it kind of feeds racism and misogyny, and it becomes kind of this toxic witch's brew that Trump exploited so skillfully during the election. But that is part of it. You know, you're not really going to believe that the Democratic Party, just as an example, is looking out for your best interest if you kind of associate them with, you know, a political and media establishment that is constantly making jokes at your expense, or at the very least just hasn't really fought for your votes and hasn't invested in your area and doesn't seem to really kind of be in touch with the issues that you care about. You have to make the case, and Trump made the case at the very least. Like, he's kind of failed him later on, but at least he bothered to make the case. And I really think that, you know, the Democratic Party needs to take that lesson away from the election.
Sarah Jones, Her article in the New Republic is J.D. Vance, The False Prophet of Blue America. Sarah, thank you so much for spending time with us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.